Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Radio stations across the country, across the world, even on satellite radio. So I assume that all over the Alpha Quadrant, they are hearing this broadcast. And that's good because Mark Brumley is president of Ignatius Press, the most important publisher in the Alpha Quadrant. Mark Brumley, thanks for being with us.
Hey, you know, I'm happy to be with you there, but I will not take credit for Ignatius Press being the most important publishing company in the Alpha Quadrant. Father Fessio founded it, and lots of other people are responsible for its awesomeness. Let's all acknowledge that there are other awesome publishing companies in the Alpha Quadrant, not least of which is Catholic Answers Publishing.
Well, aren't you nice? That's a very nice thing to say. And you carry a whole bunch of our books.
Yeah, so you know it's all the Alpha Quadrant Catholic publishing team. You know,
that's right. That's right. We're all in this together. I feel like I feel like I'm going to start break out singing right now.
So can I mention something which I feel only slightly awkward in pushing this, you know, but yeah. I do want to mention a book that we came out with last season because it is an awesome book and.
Why don't you feel really awkward about that? I'm curious. What book is it?
Well, it's a book called Wisdom and Wonder, and its subtitle is How Peter Kraft Shaped the Next Generation of Catholics. And it's edited by Brandon Vaught of Word on Fire fame.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful little book about – it's written by a number of people, a number of contributors. I won't read them all, but Brandon Vaught is the editor and a contributor and all that. And, you know, Catholic Answers' own Trent Horn contributed an essay called Peter Kraft and Pro-Life Persuasion. And some of your authors and our other authors and our mutual authors even, have contributed things on how Peter Kraft really made a difference to their faith, including a lot of converts. So I'm going to hold this up for the people that can see it. And it's got a picture of Peter Kraft on the cover. And again, it's called Wisdom and Wonder, How Peter Kraft Shaped the Next Generation of Catholics. And Peter did not know we were doing this book, and he found out about it. He was at first not really pleased or enthused. He was not. But, you know, I think he felt honored. But he doesn't, you know, he's a kind of humble guy. And so some of us had to say, no, we're doing it. Tough luck, pal.
Yeah.
Too bad. Because you have to have the humility to accept the fact that God has used you as an instrument in so many people's lives.
Right.
And so we publish we're not the only publisher, Peter Kraft, but probably principal publisher.
Right.
But he's got a lot of other publishers out there. So, you know, in talking about the Alpha Quadrant, you know, Catholic League of Publishers, there are a lot of other publishers that publish Kraft, but somebody we all have in common, or most of us have in common, is Peter Kraft, and he's such a blessing as a philosopher, as an apologist.
Right.
And as is, he would deny being a theologian, but he is a theologian, not by training, but by, you know, his actual study and what he does. And he's just a great gift to the church. So I would encourage people to get Wisdom and Wonder, How Peter Kraft Shaped the Next Generation of Catholics. Edited by Brandon Vaught and published by us at Ignatius Press.
Well, good for you and for Brandon. That's great that he did that. I remember when Peter Kraft was out here and doing the show with us, and I asked him, "Do you realize like what it means to people when you come around here?" And he goes, "I don't." He goes, "No, I don't think I do. I just do my work. You know, I just continue to do the work." And he was delightful and very humble. But what a towering figure in apologetics.
Yeah, I know. And he acknowledges that he's a philosopher and he approaches things philosophically. He doesn't like it when people try to suggest he's a great philosopher because he doesn't do a lot of original kind of, you know, scholarly philosophical work. And he's never wanted to do that. He's always wanted to make philosophy accessible to people and use philosophy in service of the faith. But he's still a great philosopher. You know, a great philosopher is someone who gets you thinking about the great ideas and the great issues in life and how to live and why are we here and all of that. And while, you know, he hasn't written the definitive textbook on David Hume or some really obscure philosophical point, he writes tons and tons of books that get people thinking about God and the faith, tons of apologetics, and just basic good old-fashioned philosophy. So
it's like a Festschrift.
Yeah, it's kind of a Festschrift without the highfalutin
fest.
And a lot of fest, but without the highfalutin scholarly connotation that comes with that.
Very good, very good. Say the name of it just one more time, and then Ignatius.com is where you can go to get it. Just go to Ignatius, or anywhere where they have good Catholic books, I'm sure.
Right. And you guys might sell it too. You probably do. It's called Wisdom and Wonder, subtitle How Peter Crafe Shaped the Next Generation of Catholics. And it's got lots of testimonies and how people came into the church and how their faith was sustained and particular arguments that helped them. And it's got a great little list of in the appendices, How to Read Peter Crafe by Brandon Vaught, different subject areas. You know, of course, we published this in the fall, and of course it's now out of date in that list because there are several Crafe books that have come out since then. So,
well, that's going to happen anytime. He's just going to get, yeah.
We've got one coming out this season, next season, and that's just us, you know. So
very good. 888-318-7884 is our number. It's open forum. Mark Brumley is our guest, and let's head off to calls. Greg in Omaha, Nebraska, listening to EWTN on channel 130, Sirius XM satellite radio. Greg, thanks for the call. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi, Mark. So my question is, my son came to me and said that his theology teacher at his Catholic high school told him that John the Evangelist and John the Apostle were not the same person. And I thought that I had heard somewhere, and I can't remember which person on Catholic radio told me or I heard it from, but that was an old theory and that they have found evidence that they are the same person. So just wanted to find out some resources that I could point my son, to steer him correctly, or myself, if I'm incorrect, to correct myself.
Okay, very good question. First of all, I should know that the Gospel of John doesn't have an attribution that says this was written by John the Apostle, or this wasn't written by John the Apostle, it was written by John somebody else. We know who wrote it based on the earliest traditions of the church, and so those earliest traditions have John, the son of Zebedee, also called John the Apostle, as the author. Now, there are theories based upon some early references among the church fathers and other writings to another John. And there are theories that perhaps because John would have been a very old man at the time that the Gospel of John is thought to have been written, so generally thought to have been written in the 90s. So Jesus died and rose again around the year 30. And John is generally thought to have been the last gospel based on the earliest traditions. And so the thinking has been that it was probably written in the 90s. Some people think it was written around 70, maybe even before the fall of Jerusalem in AD 70. But probably majority opinion is that it's written in the 90s. So John would have been very old, not impossibly old, but very old. And so because he would have been very old, it is sometimes supposed that he didn't actually put pen to paper, as it were, or pen to parchment or pen to papyrus, but that he had assistance or help. And so indication of this is sometimes found if you look at the last chapter of the Gospel of John, John chapter 21. You will see that it is preceded in the immediate verse before it, or a couple verses before it, by what looks like a closing out. You know, so John 20, verse 30 says, "Now Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book, but these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So some people think, well, that sounds like he's closing out. You go to chapter 21, it says, "After this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples by the Sea of Tiberias," and so on. And we get the account of Jesus talking to Peter and say, "Feed my sheep," and Peter's response. And then at the end of that chapter, Peter says, what's going to happen to this one, the beloved disciple, the person who is seen as the author or the source of the book? And Jesus says, none of your business, basically.
Yeah.
And then in verse 24, it says, this is the disciple who is bearing witness to these things, who has written these things, and we know that his testimony is true. So you notice it says it's the disciple who's written these things, who's bearing witness to these things, and then we know that his testimony is true. So that some theorizing is, well, there's John who's actually the bearing witness, and maybe he's written some of it. In fact, maybe he wrote 20 chapters of this, but this last chapter was tacked on at the end by the community because John has passed away by this point. And so you get this idea that there's a distinction between the evangelist and the source of the material, or a distinction between the source or witness to the material, who is thought to be John, and the process of writing it, where either John wrote, whether someone, either someone else wrote the closing chapter 21, or perhaps someone else actually wrote the other material based on the testimony and based upon other written material from John. And so we have a distinction between John, the apostle, the source of the gospel material, whether that's oral source or it's also in writing, and John, the evangelist, who perhaps finalized the gospel and added this final chapter, who was representing this community that's speaking of, speaking with reference to we believe that his testimony is true. So that's a theory. We don't know. But in any case, the tradition of the church is the source for the Gospel of John, whether that means the guy that actually penned the whole gospel, all 21 chapters, or penned 20 chapters and 21 came later, whether he also wrote or he just was the oral source of it. The source of the Gospel of John is, in the earliest tradition, John the Apostle, who's also called the beloved disciple. And the rest is theorizing with more or less weight of argument that can be produced and evidence from interpretations in the early church. So I not having heard what the teacher actually said, and I understand, although, you know, your son may be doing his best to represent it accurately, he may not have caught all the nuances. It doesn't sound like the teacher's necessarily wrong. It is at least a widely held theory, but is by no means, certain. And in any case, the authority, the apostolic authority behind the fourth gospel, the Gospel of John, is John the Apostle.
What do you think, Greg?
Thank you. The reason he actually asked the question was because he went to his youth group last night at church and watched the first episode of The Chosen, the second season of The Chosen. And, where they if you haven't seen it, it's an account of John, the Gospel of John, like John's writing it. And so he came home and he said, well, I didn't like that episode because it was inaccurate. My teacher said, John didn't write this. So,
well, if I'm remembering correctly, I may be misremembering, but I think that it's not John that's taking notes there, it's Matthew. And the idea is that Matthew is taking notes for what will eventually become his gospel. But I may be misremembering that. But in any case, even if it is John in The Chosen, two things need to be kept in mind. One, The Chosen is based on history in the Gospels, but it's fictionalized, so you're going to have things in there that didn't happen exactly as they're represented in the Bible. So that's point one. Point two, we don't know whether John took notes. I mean, it is most biblical scholars, New Testament scholars, will talk about oral traditions, and they'll have a whole account of how the events and teaching of Jesus came to be written into our Gospels. And much of that has a good, solid scholarly basis. Some of it is speculation, maybe well-founded speculation, but it's speculation. So we have to be careful when we say, well, that didn't happen, or that couldn't have happened. It couldn't have been that that any of the disciples took notes. That would have never happened. This is widely disputed, or strongly disputed, among New Testament scholars today, the extent to which note-taking was something that was allowed by disciples of rabbinic-type teachers in first-century Judaism. And in any case, you know, we're talking about Jesus, who is not necessarily to be regarded as following exactly the pattern of other Jewish teachers in the first century. So while we don't have any reason to think that the gospel writers were sitting down and writing their gospels as eyewitnesses, there are good reasons by when you compare Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the so-called synoptic gospels, for thinking that didn't happen that way. That doesn't mean there were not written sources or that the oral sources did not come to be written down early on, and therefore we can just dismiss things like you see depicted in The Chosen as just contrary to what we know to have happened.
Greg, thanks very much for the call. It's important, though, that the young people do get an education at a Catholic school in which they come to a sense of trust for the gospel. So whatever else happens, I would like to send you, we have a video. It's Jimmy Akin made it, and it's called Why You Can Trust the Gospels. So if you hang on the line, I have to take this break. We'll send you a copy of Why You Can Trust the Gospels.
And I'd also
recommend Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
Hi, I'm Kristalina Everett, and I am so blessed to have a great new show on EWTN Radio. It's called Women Made New, where women help women get closer to God. Through honest conversations with our guests about the challenges we face in our lives, we're reminded that no matter what mistakes we've made, it's never too late to start over. When we receive healing from the God who makes all things new. That's Women Made New every Saturday at 12 noon Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, is our guest, and anybody can call 888-318-7884. We got our signals crossed, and there was another recommendation you wanted to make to Greg before we went
to I highly recommend the Jimmy Akin resource that you referred to, but I also recommend the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible, either the Whole New Testament or the volume on the Gospel of John, because there's a great introduction there that talks about questions of authorship and so on and dating. And while there are lots of things we don't know, there are a lot of other things that we do know and we can be confident of. And when it comes to the apostolic origins of the Gospels, whether they're written by apostles or in the case of Mark and Luke, written by apostolic men closely associated with the apostles, that they go to the very sources of the teaching about Jesus. People, witnesses who heard Jesus teach, saw what Jesus did, and that's really what we need to convey. And we were talking during the break how it can be a challenge for a high school teacher, as you said, referring to the late Cardinal Dulles, make sure you catechize before you try to get into theology, that people have to be grounded in their faith, understand their faith before they go deeply into, just trying to understand on a very high-end level. And sometimes it's hard for high school teachers because they want to be they do want to catechize the kids and build up their faith, but they get questions. And those questions sometimes are of a nature that they're really kind of theological questions. And then even when you state the answer correctly, and I know this has happened to me on Catholic Answers, and it happened to me years ago when we were doing seminars, and I know it happens to other apologists. You can give a right answer, but people don't always hear it correctly.
Yes. Right. That's exactly right. But you just got to be so careful with the young ones that we're not teaching a skepticism before they have heard the gospel, before they've heard the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, because it can come across, well, they tell you that John wrote the fourth gospel.
Yeah, they tell
but
you
the
that.
Truth is, you know.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Aiden in Kentucky, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone, Aiden. I think, personally, best app in the Alpha Quadrant. I'm going to go out on a limb on that one. Aiden, go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi. My question basically deals with, like, shopping on Sunday or, like, going places like a bowling alley or laser tag or snow tubing, things of that nature where you might have to pay somebody else to work. Because I read something in the Catechism that said something to the effect of, like, you shouldn't make people needlessly labor on Sunday. So I just was curious as to what you had to say on that.
Okay. We know there's a commandment, keep holy the Lord's day, fourth commandment. And in the Old Testament, of course, that was the Sabbath day, and there were very, very strict requirements of what you could do and not do on the Sabbath. The New Testament is not – in the Christian order of things, we do not observe the Sabbath in that way, but we still have the Lord's day, which is, for reasons which we won't go into here, observed by Christians on Sunday. One quickie on that, tied to the resurrection of the Lord, the fulfillment of the Old Testament order of things. Jesus rose from the dead on Sunday. So the Christian weekly holy day, that the observance of which fulfills the commandment, the fourth commandment, is Sunday. But here's what the Catechism says about it. It says it refers to it as a day of grace and rest from work. Article 2184, just as God, quote, rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done, unquote, human life has a rhythm of work and rest. The institution of the Lord's Day helps everyone enjoy adequate rest and leisure to cultivate their familial, cultural, social, and religious lives. So notice it talks about rest and leisure to cultivate familial, cultural, social, and religious life. So you can engage in familial, cultural, social, and religious activities. 2185, on Sunday and other holy days of obligation, the faithful are to refrain from engaging in work or activities that hinder the worship owed to God, the joy proper to the Lord's Day, the performance of works of mercy, and appropriate relaxation of mind and body. So we're to avoid activities that hinder us giving the worship due to God. Normally that means going to Holy Mass, among other things. The joy proper to the day, so you need to enjoy a day off. The performance of works of mercy, so if we're out trying to serve other people, responding to suffering. That's what mercy is, love's response to suffering. We need to be unhindered in that, and appropriate relaxation of mind and body. Family needs to continue, or important social service can legitimately excuse from the obligation of Sunday rest. So, you know, I usually make breakfast for my wife on Sunday, right? She usually cooks for me during the week. Well, that's work. That's a family obligation I feel I have to my wife. And it also refers to social service. So there are social activities, important services that are provided, people need, and that legitimate excuses from the obligation of Sunday rest. The faithful should see to it that legitimate excuses do not lead to habits prejudicial to religion, family life, and health. And then it goes on to say, the charity of truth seeks holy leisure. The necessity of charity accepts just work. And that's a quote from St. Augustine. And then the article 2186 says, those Christians who have leisure should be mindful of their brethren who do have the same needs and the same rights, yet cannot rest from work because of poverty and misery. Sunday is traditionally consecrated by Christian piety, good works, and so on. So it's talking about we need to be mindful of the fact that other people have to work on this day because they're poor, and we should try to relieve their suffering to the extent we can so that they don't have to work and they can freely do it. 2187 goes on to talk about the topic in more detail. So while it's true, we can do things like go to the store and things of that sort that involve the work of other people where we need to, we should try to minimize that because we are creating an environment where other people have to work. who would like to have a day off. And so that's part. And we can do other things, you know, play sports, which are forms of relaxation of the body. We can engage in cultural activities, forms of renewal of the mind and body and mind and spirit from a cultural point of view. But at the heart of Sunday is Sunday worship of God. And for Christians, that means going to church. And for Catholics, it means attending Holy Mass.
Aidan, thanks for that question. Lots more folks on the line. Mark Brumley, president of Ignatius Press, is our guest. Right back with more calls for him right after this on this open forum on Catholic Answers Live.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Thank you, Sarah. A little bit of groovy music there. Because it's Thursday and we like to play the groovy music on Thursdays. Mark Brumley, our guest. 1 million people on the phone lines ready to talk to Mark, so got to get right back to the phones. Mark Brumley, of course, president of Ignatius Press. He was mentioning right at the beginning of the program a brand new book, or well, not brand new book, but a new book from Ignatius Press by a whole bunch of younger apologists and theologians and converts to the Catholic faith in honor of the work, the life, the example of Peter Kraft, formerly, maybe presently, from Boston College, of Boston College. I don't know. Just say the name of the book again, Mark.
It is Wisdom and Wonder,
yep.
The How Peter Kraft Shaped the Next Generation of Catholics.
Ignatius.com is where you can go to get it. Now I've forgotten what order I was in. Kathy, I'm going to go to you. You won the lottery, Kathy. Kathy in Kentucky, listening on Sacred Heart Radio. You're up next. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi, Mark. I have a question about when your loved one dies and goes to, I don't know, purgatory or heaven, wherever they may go. If you ask them to do something for you, does God allow them to come back and do that for you? And the reason I'm asking is because my son died 2 years ago. Oh. And a few weeks after he died, I asked him to find the remains of a young lady who had been missing for 9.5 years, who was the mother of this girl, which is one of his really good friend's fiance. And the case had been ongoing for 9.5 years and constantly, you know, trying to get information about it. And then, like, 2 weeks after I asked him to do that, they found her.
Mm. Wow.
Well, thanks be to God, good came out of that situation. What I would say is, in general, the Catholic Church does not encourage us to see those who've died and gone on to be with the Lord as people who are sort of, and I know you didn't mean that this way, but kind of at our beck and call. We pray for them. We can ask their intercession, and if God wishes to utilize them in their intercession, that's up to him. I know there's a theological discussion about the extent to which souls in purgatory can intercede for other people, but when someone dies, I don't know that that person is in purgatory. You know, for all I know, that person is in heaven. And so when if I ask that person's intercession, then I'm just hoping that that person is praying for me and for what I'm asking for with the Lord and in the Lord. So now whether God will utilize that person in some way beyond responding to his prayers, I don't think we know. We do know that sometimes people who have gone on to the next life and in the Bible are brought into play, as it were. We have the example of Moses and Elijah within the ministry of Jesus. They conversed with Jesus, and of course Peter, James, and John were there on the Mount of Transfiguration and saw them and so on. So it's certainly not outside of the realm of possibility or something inherently contradictory to the way God works. But the Bible wants us to not get too involved with the dead in that way. You know, that's part of the idea about in the Old Testament about not invoking the dead or trying to call up the dead, because we can come to a place where we think that there's sort of an independent access to those in the afterlife that we have. And in fact, we don't. What access we have to them comes through Christ and the relationship with Christ and in the communion of saints. So whatever things that tasks that God may have for those who've gone on to be with the Lord, those are tasks that happen in Christ, and it's not like we have this kind of independent activity that we can engage in. Does that help?
Kathy?
What you're saying is that if I just said, please, you know, help find her, then he could have gone to God and said, hey, how about it? And maybe right. God said, okay, hey, yeah, it's time. Right. The weird thing right. about that was about a week after I actually did, it was out of despair because her mother was just so distraught still 9.5 years later. And I was feeling so grateful that at least they found my son. You know,
mm-hmm.
He wasn't out there lost for 9.5 years. But the girl herself appeared to a guy who does a podcast in a dream and told him all about how she was killed. And then he contacted her mother. That happened like a week after I asked this. And then like a week later, a hunter found her remains. In between.
I'm sorry, Kathy. I was going to ask Mark just to kind of sum up because we have a lot of folks on the line, but what do you make of all that, Mark?
I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. You know, mysterious things happen. Maybe we should bring in Jimmy. You know, this sounds like something from Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
It doesn't. This does. You know, that's so funny. Of all the apologists we have, there's one person where people go, that sounds like a Jimmy Akin question. Like, you don't really get a, that sounds like a Trent Horn question, but the new right, Jimmy right. Akin, there is. Kathy, I'm sorry to cut you off.
I certainly wouldn't say that it couldn't happen, you know, that didn't happen, right. couldn't happen, or anything like that. So.
Yeah, but I don't know is a fair response. I wanted to get to Francesca before we had to go to a break in Studio City, California, sure. listening on EWTN. Hi, Francesca, are you there with us?
Hi.
Hi, how old are you, Francesca?
I'm 9.
Francesca, did your brother call recently?
Yeah, my brother calls sometimes.
Yeah. All right. I thought so. Because we don't get all that many calls from Studio City. So it's very nice to hear you. Francesca, go ahead with your question for Mr. Brumley.
So one of my friends gave my other friend a mean note. And It said to one of my friends that she was annoying. And it said to my other friend that they were a show-off and we were one. And I just want to know what you think we should do.
Very good question, Francesca. And I'm going to say, you know, you got some choices. One choice might be simply to ignore the note and or the notes and pray for the friends who wrote the mean things. The other might be, you know, to talk to the person and say, you know, that note was kind of mean, but, you know, you're still our friend and, you know, we're going to pray for you. We're praying for you. Something like that. Do you feel like you have a good enough friendship with these folks to talk that way to them?
Well, I'm new to the school.
Okay.
I don't know that I would be very useful for it.
Okay. Well, that's fine. Then you can just pray for your friends, and if your friend asks advice, you can say, you know, we should, you know, try to forgive this person. We don't want to become mean like that and do mean things. And one way to avoid that is, you know, not to say anything, but if your friend thinks that something needs to be said, then you could support your friend by saying, you know, you might tell this person that said this mean, wrote this mean note to you, that was a mean note, but that you forgive the person.
Okay, Francesca?
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Francesca.
You're welcome.
All right, and say hi to your brother for us.
Okay.
Bye, Francesca. We have to take a quick break. Right back with more Open Forum with Mark Brumley, solving the world's problems, bringing peace to the young ones, right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
One of the reasons we should go to Mass is because it is the food of the saints that we receive. And for the saints, they understood rightly that the time after Holy Communion, that those moments are the most precious moments of our lives.
The Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, live from the EWTN Chapel, every morning, 8 Eastern, on EWTN Radio and Television.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Mark Brumley, our guest. Lots and lots of folks on the line, so we will keep moving. I hope that was helpful to Francesca. Manny, sure. In Midland, Texas, listening on the radio. Glad to have you, Manny. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And speaking of wisdom and wonder, I have a question about King Solomon.
He was wise.
I did a Google search. Yeah, well, I don't think he was that wise if he had that many wives and concubines. That's a lot of trouble if you ask me. So
that's one way to think about it.
Yeah. Well, and Google also said that he only had like 3 kids. Is that pretty reliable? And if that's true, did he make his wives or concubines have abortions or something?
I don't know about that. I remember Rehoboam. That's the only one I remember.
Rehoboam, yeah. I mean, I know Solomon is famous for having 700 wives or something like that, and I'm sure that he had more than three children. Rehoboam was his son who inherited the kingdom, and then because, you know, Father Fester was giving a homily the other day, and he's talking about how Solomon started out pretty wise, but then, you know, kind of departed from that as he got older. He made this great prayer of God asking for wisdom, and he got it, but then
he squandered it,
and you see the effects of that squandering on his son Rehoboam, who Solomon himself was rather harsh as a king, and then his son becomes even harsher as a king and winds up causing a civil war. So we have a split between Judah and Israel being the northern kingdom and Judah being the southern kingdom. And, you know, Solomon has some responsibility for that. And I have to think that having 700 wives didn't help him be a good father.
That would make it a little difficult to be a good father, I would think. That's pretty far from the design of fatherhood.
Well, and also having so many wives, they wound up having a deleterious influence on him. It wasn't just a matter of, are you crazy? You have 700 wives. You know, they corrupted him in a lot of ways, spiritually corrupted him. And that, again, had its effect on the united monarchy, and then later when it divided, it had an effect there too. So it was not a good thing.
So is that what you were looking for, Manny, whether he was a good dad or not?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, and you know, what happened having that many wives, I can't believe he only had that few children. I mean, I just kind of was wondering, you know, in real life, you're going to have more, you're going to have more than just three kids if you have that many. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so, I think there may be three that are identified by now. I don't recall. It's been a long time since I read up on Solomon. But, you know, it may be that there were only three sons identified or something of that sort. I'd have to go back and check that. But it certainly is not. It's highly unlikely that he had only three children with 700 wives.
Thanks, Manny. I'm going to go to Colleen now in Quincy, Illinois, listening on the EWTN app. Colleen, glad to have you here with us. Go ahead, please, with your question for Mark Brumley.
Hello. Actually, a comment first. A caller at the end of the show yesterday, Martha, who called in saying she had difficulty believing in the full presence of Jesus in the Eucharist at times. Mm-hmm. And I just thought of something comforting that she could easily find in her missalette. The second to last page usually is the down in adoration falling in the beginning of adoration,
right,
where one of the lines says, faith will tell us God is present when our human senses fail.
Yeah.
And I really, take a lot of that and from that. And also in the back page, Thanksgiving after Holy Communion, the prayer of St. Thomas Aquinas is real helpful.
Yes,
so I just thought,
good,
if you wanted to expand on that, is it a feeling that we believe, or is it our faith that we believe
in
the real presence of Jesus?
Our conviction as Catholics that Christ is really, truly, substantially present, body, blood, soul, and divinity, in other words, the whole Christ, is present under the appearances of bread and wine, the things that we can see and smell and taste, those aspects of bread and wine, we call the appearances of bread and wine. Our conviction that Christ is truly and really present is a matter of faith. It's not something you can demonstrate. There are Eucharistic miracles, but even those miracles require faith to believe. So that they are sort of amplifications to deepen our faith, special signs to deepen our faith in the real presence, but they don't prove the real presence. You can't demonstrate that, because if you could demonstrate it, it wouldn't be faith. So it's a conviction that has to do with trusting that what God has said is true and what God has promised will come to pass. Now, some people, where does apologetics come into that? Well, one role of apologetics is to show that we have good reasons for thinking that God has actually said this. So when we look at the scripture and the early tradition of the church, we can see that God has revealed that he's that the bread and wine, the Eucharist, become the body and blood of Christ and so on. That's one thing. And the other role that apologetics plays is answering objections. People say, well, how could bread and wine become body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus Christ? Because, you know, Jesus is, if you believe that he's risen from the dead, then he's a transformed, glorified, resurrected body. But how could bread and wine be that? And so then we start talking about the way in which the church understands the presence of Christ. It's a substantial present under the appearances or under the forms of bread and wine. But we're not saying if you break open a host, and I don't mean to be this disrespectful, we're not saying if you break open a host, you're going to see bones. Or if you put the precious blood of Christ under a microscope, you're going to see blood cells or things of that sort. That's not the nature of the – it's not what we claim. We claim that Christ is present. And how he's present. He's present sacramentally under the forms of signs, the signs, what you can see and what you can hear and taste and touch. Those are signs that point to Christ giving himself as spiritual food, as sacrifice to us. And he is really, that is to say, independent of our thinking about it. Whether we think about him being there or not, he's there. We may not benefit from him if we don't think about him being there, but he's there whether we think about him or not. That's what it means to say the presence is real. It's not a presence that's imaginary. We say it's substantial. That means it's not just the presence of his spirit, but his whole self is there. So apologetics comes in, helps us believe in the real presence by clearing away misconceptions or responding to objections. But when all is said and done, it's a disposition of faith to believe that Christ is doing what he said he would do and that the church is understanding Christ properly when the church says, this is what Jesus meant, this is what Jesus has commanded us to do, and this is why we do it.
Colleen, thanks. I'm going to keep moving because the lines continue full. Let's go to Arthur in Lubbock, Texas, listening on Our Lady of Victory Radio. Arthur, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mark.
Hey, Mark, especially when you were dealing with that question about John, I was wondering, as publisher, the imprintor, what's your obligation to keep out things that are these speculations and this in non-academic works and the bias and the different hermeneutics that come into play? What obligation do you have, and how do you pursue making sure everything you publish is 100% in line with the faith?
Good question. You know, we do – obviously, Father Fessio has a doctorate in theology, and I have, you know, a master's degree in theology. We have other people who are theologically literate, and so we're reviewing manuscripts. We have, you know, colleagues and experts and all those folks that we can consult with and do consult with when it comes to theological works and things of that sort. So we have some training, and that's helpful and important when you're going to be dealing with theological books. You have to look at what a book is used for. Is the book going to be used for – is it intended to be used for seminary training or things of that sort, in which case official sort of – well, not sort of – official ecclesiastical approval comes into play. And when we're dealing with Bible translation, Bible notes, for example, one of the reasons why we are still – we don't have the whole Ignatius Catholic Study Bible published yet is because while all the notes and all annotations and all that are now all written, they have to be reviewed by diocesan censors who make sure that there's nothing in those things there's nothing in those things contrary to the faith of the church. So it depends on what it's going to be used for and what the nature of the writing is. Then more broadly, when you're dealing with theological works, which are works of some sophistication, you have a different range of opinions that you can allow and that we're willing to publish, because the thinking is that those are going to be books that people who have some measure of theological competence are going to be reading. They're not, you know, going to be used in high school with little kids or in grade school with little kids. We have catechetical materials that are used for those purposes, and they have to be reviewed not just by diocesan people, but by the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops to get a conformity to, with the catechism approval statement. So show that what we're teaching is in conformity with the catechism of the Catholic Church. So that's stuff for kids. Then things that are for a more popular audience, you're not quite as, you don't have as much leeway as you have when you're dealing with sophisticated theological stuff, but you're not having to scrutinize it quite as carefully as you are when you're dealing with little kids. You're aimed at popular adult readers, and so you presume that they have basically a rudimentary knowledge of the faith, or if they don't have that, that they can get it and they can recognize that maybe they need some additional help to understand correctly what they're reading. But you try to avoid popular books, things that are of a more speculative, debatable nature, because people may not have the wherewithal to deal with those things properly. So that's what you try to do, recognizing that it's going to be it's going to vary. There are some people that are not theologically literate, but you know, are more disposed to find out things for themselves, and therefore can handle higher level material, even in a popular book. And other people, they're not up to it. They're not ready for it. It's like when I teach theology classes, and I teach, you know, adult ed classes, and I teach graduate level theology and diaconal formation theology. I teach that at different levels. So if I'm forming someone for ministry, that's something that's different from when I'm doing an adult ed class in a parish. And when I'm doing graduate theology that isn't necessarily aimed at formation for ministry, that's something further still. So you got to kind of make judgments about your audience and try to do your best not to confuse.
Arthur, thanks. Again, lots of folks on the line, so I'm going to keep moving. I'm going to go to Chris in New York, listening on the Catholic Answers app. And Chris, you're going to have to be quick with the question if you'd like an answer.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I'm wondering what specifically constitutes grave matter, and how would one know whether a matter is grave? Like, for instance, if someone tells a white lie, but they're still knowingly with full consent breaking the commandment, telling a lie with full knowledge, or if, for instance, if someone, like for adultery in the heart, how would one know when they've ventured past the threshold of venial into mortal sin, or how to judge whether something is grave?
Mark?
Generally, an explicit violation of one of the commandments in the explicit language of the commandment constitutes grave matter. Whether or not one is culpable for a mortal sin, of course, depends upon knowledge and consent. So, for example, if I violate the first commandment and I have another God, that is clearly grave matter. If I have sexual relations with someone other than my wife, that's clearly grave matter. If I I murder somebody, that's clearly grave matter. Now, we go down another level when you try to get at the underlying moral principle behind the commandment as articulated. And that's where things like the example you gave of committing adultery with someone in your heart, you know, basically the sin of lust comes into play, and you have to say, well, this is a serious matter. It pertains to one of the commandments. Do I realize it's wrong? Am I freely choosing to do it? So it can be more difficult in those cases because, you know, how am I engaged in this act of lust or committing adultery in my heart? As I glance at something, am I going on the internet looking for porn or that kind of thing? So there's some in that area. When we get in that area, there's some room for ambiguity, and you have to ask. You know, that's why you need to do these things and review these matters with a confessor.
Chris, thanks very much. Other callers, I'm so sorry we didn't get to you. Maybe we can talk with you tomorrow. Mark Brumley has been our guest, president of Ignatius Press. Find out what they do at Ignatius.com. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Cy. God bless you.
You too. Thanks. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.